Good evening. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, a Malaysian court finds Anwar Ibrahim guilty of sodomy. Members of China's National People's Congress are looking to change the body's image. And we look at Tibet's complicated history with Beijing. It's all ahead on VOA's Crossroads Asia. A Malaysian appeals court has overturned opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim's 2012 acquittal on charges of sodomy. The Court of Appeals ruled today that Anwar was guilty of having sex in 2008 with a man who was then his aide. A lower court acquitted Anwar in 2012, ruling the DNA evidence in the trial was contaminated. Sodomy is punishable by up to 20 years in prison under a colonial-era law in Malaysia. The 66-year-old former deputy prime minister says the charges are an attempt by the government to ruin his political career. The ruling will complicate Anwar's hopes of running in a local by-election on March 23rd. Many expected the veteran politician would win the seat. This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Coming up, we mark International Women's Day. China's National People's Congress has long been viewed as a rubber stamp body. Critics say that when the Congress is in session, delegates do little but hold meetings, walk around, listen to reports, and file a few complaints. But members of the legislative body, which are holding their 60th session in the capital, Beijing, this week, are looking to change that image. Rebecca Valley reports for VOA from Hong Kong.
Asked about public perception of lawmakers at a news conference earlier this week, the MPC spokeswoman Fu Ying said it's possible society misunderstands the workings of China's parliament. Fu says that in a year as an MPC representative, she has attended many meetings. She says they are important and very meaningful. As an example, she talked about inspections carried out by delegates in schools throughout the country. The survey, she said, was to verify how a 2006 amendment to the compulsory education law was carried out and how money had been spent. In recent years, pressed by a more outspoken public opinion, the Chinese government has tried to portray the image of a functioning parliament, where delegates look like the people they represent and are responsive to the will of their constituency. The number of party officials that make up the majority of lawmakers has gradually decreased in the past few years, and the government has included more seats for migrant workers, farmers, and other representatives of the grassroots. Lim Fang is acting dean at the law school at City University in Hong Kong.
If you look at, for example, different ethnic minority groups and different sectors in the government or in the society, they all have their representatives. But once a motion is put forward there, whether it can actually move forward to achieve something, I'm not sure.
By constitution, the MPC is given a large range of powers, from amending laws and the constitution to approving the state budget and electing top officials. However, many of these powers are exercised in name only. Analysts believe that the real debate over policy details happens ahead of the MPC and within China's bureaucracies and ministries. That is why, they say, some motions have lingered in draft stage for years, only to pass with overwhelming majorities once they're finally presented at the MPC. During the current session, lawmakers will be discussing 68 bills, but the body doesn't expect to pass all of the legislation immediately. Instead, it has given itself a five-year time frame.
The agenda is set more or less for 5 years, and it's rather difficult to insert something additional there.
That doesn't mean that lawmakers are not trying. Rory Truex is a doctoral candidate at Yale's Political Science Department and has looked at the work of delegates in his dissertation. He found that deputies are growing more active and receiving better training.
Currently this year, there's probably about 9,000 different opinions and motions that are being put forth. And that's up from perhaps only a few thousand, maybe 10 years ago. So the government is really focusing on getting deputies to really do their job.
By looking at the deputies' training material, Truex found that in the hierarchy of their duties, representing the will of the people comes first, while protecting the interests of the party is only second in ranking.
Tacitly, deputies know that in the end, they're supposed to represent the interests of the party first. But occasionally, we will see deputies really take their representative responsibilities very seriously and really challenge the authority of the party.
That has been the case with motions requiring officials to disclose their assets.
It's an interesting example because it shows how occasionally the interests of the party and the interests of the people might conflict. It puts NPC deputies right in the middle.
With rampant corruption in every sector of Chinese society, people's anger often turns around graft among officials who are expected by communist mandate to serve the people. A number of representatives have called for measures to make the government more transparent, including a lawyer from Chongqing who has repeatedly proposed a sunshine bill for 7 years. Analysts believe that while the debate has gained some momentum behind closed doors, leaders are wary of pushing the issue too far into the public eye, and Xi Jinping's administration has punished with jail terms those who do. Su Zhiyong, a legal scholar and founder of the New Citizen Movement, was recently given a 4 year jail sentence for having advocated, among other things, that senior leaders take the lead in disclosing their assets. Han Deyun, the representative from Chongqing, who has for years lobbied for a sunshine bill, told Chinese media he is not pushing the motion anymore. In 2012, he received a response saying the relevant departments were looking carefully into the legislation. The way delegates are selected also acts as a guarantee of loyalty to the party. Despite democratic elections at the village and township level, it is difficult for non-party members to effectively win seats locally, let alone be appointed to the NPC, says Lin Feng.
Every now and then you see some reports about, say, certain independent candidates get elected. But if you put it in the big picture, you will see the percentage is very small.
He says that if they're in the minority, they won't be able to change the whole picture. Rebecca Valley for VOA News in Hong Kong.
Tomorrow is International Women's Day. The United Nations Women's Executive Director, Phumzile Mlongo Nkuka, had this statement about the occasion.
We come together guided by the certainty that equality for women is progress for all. By ending women's poverty, we will sustainably and significantly reduce poverty of all people of the world. By keeping girls in school longer and offering quality education, we will ensure that more women and girls have a chance to play their full role in society, the economy, and in decision making. We need women's equal representation in leadership positions, in peacemaking, in communities, in politics, in business, and in religious institutions. This will contribute to a more peaceful and secure world in which the elimination of discrimination and violence against women is an imperative. We call for change and for women around the world to continue to inspire and demand change. We also make a call to men and boys, leaders in the private sector, religious leaders, and the young people of the world to join us in a world in which men and women are treated equally. By joining together in support of women and girls, you help to solve the greatest challenges of the 21st century. It requires all of us to take a stand and be on the right side of history, because equality for women is progress for all.
That is Phumzile Mlongo Nkuka, the United Nations Women's Executive Director. Well, meanwhile, the U.S. State Department has presented 10 women from 10 different countries with the 2014 International Women of Courage Award. The annual award recognizes women around the world who have demonstrated exceptional courage and leadership and advocating for peace, justice, human rights, gender equality, and women's empowerment. Deputy Secretary of State Heather Higginbottom presented the awards at a ceremony Tuesday at the State Department, along with First Lady Michelle Obama. Frances Alonso has this report.
Four women from Asia were among the 10 recipients of the U.S. State Department's 2014 International Women of Courage Award. Among the honorees are Afghanistan's Dr. Nasrin Oriokol, a leader in the field of maternal health.
Empowering a woman means empowering a society and generation. I personally experienced this, that when the Afghan woman under very harsh conditions were deprived of their basic and God-given rights for a long period of time. However, with great desire and unparalleled bravery and the support of help and the international community, they were able to change the tide against them and gain numerous achievements in the past 12 years in different aspects of life. While the obstacles and challenges such as lack of security, rule of law, domestic violence, and corruption still very much remain. But the hope and inspiration of the Afghan woman are greater than these challenges. I believe by convening gathering like this and receiving support from all members of international community, the hope of the women around the world one day would be materialized when they find themselves in an environment that they truly recognizes and appreciates the real essence of being a woman and a mother.
Lakshmi, now 25 years old, was an acid attack victim at the age of 16. Acid was thrown on her face while she waited at a bus stop in New Delhi and is permanently disfigured. But Lakshmi did not hide. She is now a campaigner in India against acid attacks and addressed her attacker in her speech.
You hurled the acid that charred my dreams. Your heart bore no love. It had that venom stored. There was never any love in your eyes. They burned me with caustic glance. I am sad that your corrosive name will always be the part of my identity that I carry with this face. Time will not come to my rescue. Every surgery will remind me of you. You will hear and you will be told that the face you burn is the face I love now. You will hear about me in the darkness of confinement. The time will be a burden for you. When you will know that I am alive, free and thriving, and living my dreams.
Other recipients from Asia include Rashika Deo, a human rights campaigner from Fiji, and Ms. Onioko Bobonazarova, a human rights activist from Tajikistan. The honorees will now travel throughout the United States through the International Visitor Leadership Program. They will end their trip in Chicago to discuss ways to work to improve the lives of women and girls worldwide.
That report by VOA's Francis Alonzo. Thai medical officials say two people were shot and wounded in separate incidents in Bangkok overnight near the main camp of anti-government protesters. The Erawan Emergency Center said today that after shots were heard near Lumpini Park, the protest site of the People's Democratic Reform Committee, a man and a woman were found wounded. They were sent to separate hospitals and have already been discharged. About 20 people have been killed and more than 700 injured since Thailand's latest round of political conflict began last November. 4 months after Typhoon Haiyan devastated parts of the Philippines, the search for the missing continues. Thousands of bodies have yet to be found or identified, and some say the process has taken too long. From Tacloban, Jason Struther has the story.
Corazon Goh's house was destroyed when Typhoon Haiyan flooded her Bayside village. But the 56-year-old lost much more than just her home.
It was the last time I saw my daughters. They could not swim in that water.
The body of one daughter, 33-year-old Ellen, was recovered, but her other child, 37-year-old Eden, has not been found. At least 2,600 bodies have been recovered in the city of Tacloban since November's typhoon, but still many more are missing. Specially trained search dogs have been flown into Tacloban from the United States to help with the recovery effort. Dog handler Jim Houck is with the group Global Dirt.
The terrain we're searching is very difficult. It's very tight mangroves. When we do find remains, we mark it, and we have to hurry up to have the locals come in to remove the remains. You know, our hope is that we go out and we don't find anything. Unfortunately, we do find remains.
Finding the remains of the missing is one challenge for Tacloban. Another is identifying the thousands of corpses that were buried in mass graves after the typhoon. Doctors are now examining those bodies and conducting DNA tests in hopes of bringing closure to those still searching for lost family. But some say they do not have enough support from the local government to get the job done. Bernardita Valenzuela is a spokeswoman for Tacloban's mayor. She says the local government is doing the best that it can, but in Typhoon Haiyan's wake, it is broke.
The structure is so massive, is so widespread, that it's not really enough. Although there are well-meaning people who come, organizations from abroad and national, it is not enough. Our resources are very limited.
As for Corazon Goh and her neighbors, they are rebuilding and trying to get back to their normal lives. But for her, that also means letting go of everything and everyone she lost to the typhoon.
After more than 3 months, we have lost hope in ever seeing the body of our daughter again.
Jason Struther for VOA News, Tacloban, the Philippines.
This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. Thursday, the Tibetan Buddhist leader, the Dalai Lama, was welcomed to a meeting of the U.S. Senate in Washington, where he presented an official opening prayer. Such public accolades for the Nobel Peace Prize winner are strongly discouraged by the Chinese government, where he's seen as a controversial figure. Communist opposition to the Dalai Lama is not new. It dates back to Tibet's 1959 uprising, during which the independence-minded Tibetan public rallied to protect the Dalai Lama from a suspected Chinese kidnap plot. The spiritual leader and many of his supporters fled to India and set up a government in exile, while those who remain carried on a guerrilla war against Chinese government domination. Tibet still has a shaky relationship with its rulers in Beijing. VOA's Dave DeForest asked Indiana University Tibetan Studies professor Elliot Spierling why the Chinese government was so intent on keeping control of Tibet in 1959.
After the period of imperialist encroachment upon China, there was this intense question of identity and intense nationalism to reclaim all that the imperialist powers had taken from China, or that they were believed to have taken from China. And with that, what had been the Manchu Empire morphed into Chinese thinking, into China, or if you will, eternal China, Chinese territory since time immemorial. And those parts that could be reclaimed became very emotional issues within China.
The Tibetans themselves, though, wanted to be an independent country.
Well, you know, there was never a plebiscite, if you will, held in Tibet, but certainly the Tibetan government itself, up to the point when the Chinese forces actually crossed the border between territory held by China and territory held by the Dalai Lama, they were certainly claiming independence. In 1959, when the Tibetans revolted, the Dalai Lama actually was not the leader of that revolt. In fact, the Dalai Lama was trying to maintain a certain status quo in Tibet, in which Tibet had autonomy. That is, the Tibetan areas under the Dalai Lama's jurisdiction had autonomy under Chinese rule. He was trying to maintain that. Nevertheless, you had the revolt, and he was swept up in that revolt. I think the Chinese are well aware of the fact that whatever the Dalai Lama says, he nevertheless is a symbol of Tibetan aspirations for Tibetans.
I guess the uprising began when it got out that the Chinese government was planning on taking the Dalai Lama to Beijing, and the people rallied around him as the leader of their cause.
Well, he was certainly the leader of Tibet. There was no doubt about that. He was trying to maintain a viable situation given the reality of the Chinese presence in Tibet. He was not trying to organize or stage a revolt against China. But what had happened was that you had already had the imposition of Chinese rule in Tibetan areas beyond his jurisdiction, and that had already been very, very bloody. You'd had mass killings in Kham, which is the southeastern portion of the Tibetan plateau, in Amdo, the northeastern portion, and the Dalai Lama himself is from Amdo. And this had provoked strong revolts, and many of the fighters who had gotten away were now in the area under the Dalai Lama's jurisdiction. What happened was that the Dalai Lama was invited to a performance at the Chinese military camp, and fears spread among the Tibetan population that this was a ploy to kidnap the Dalai Lama. In those areas outside the Dalai Lama's jurisdiction, where you'd had bloody suppression of Tibetan nationalism and of Tibetan opposition to Chinese policies, one of the tactics had also been to kidnap and, in many instances, actually to kill some revered lamas. So there was a lot of fear about the Dalai Lama going to the Chinese camp, especially as he was asked not to bring his bodyguards with him. And that was really the spark. But Lhasa already was filled with many resistance fighters.
We're several decades later. What was the significant impact of this revolt, and how does it reverberate even to this day, or does it?
It certainly does. March 10th, which is the day that the uprising started, is still an extremely sensitive date for Tibetans. Inside Tibet, it has become a day on which the police are on high alert because they fear demonstrations. So clearly it resonates. And it resonates very broadly with the population. The last major outbreak of mass protest was in 2008. China likes to say it began on March 14th when there were a number of incidents of violence, but it actually began on March 10th because March 10th is the date that resonates. In terms of understanding it, one has to realize that, of course, the uprising in 1959 was a failure. Tibetans did not drive out the People's Liberation Army. Tibet did not become independent. But had Tibetans not risen in 1959, you would not have had the Tibet issue as an issue with such resonance outside Tibet in the rest of the world. You would not have had the Dalai Lama escaping into exile. You would not have had such a large exile community in India and other places, a community which has also established roots in the West. You would have had none of that if Tibetans had not been willing to fight a battle that they could not in any way win. Sometimes one has to fight a losing battle in order to carry on a cause. And for Tibetans, they have this cause.
Elliot Spierling is Associate Professor of Tibetan Studies in the Department of Central Eurasian Studies at Indiana University. He spoke with VOA's Dave DeForest. Well, please look at our website. You can get to it at voanews.com. We have a range of stories of news and features that might interest you. Also, if you're on Facebook, look at our Facebook page. It is at VOA Asia. Thanks very much for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. I'm Sarah Williams. Please stay tuned for International Edition with Susan Yaki coming up next, and please have a great weekend.